Here, the lumber used to shore up the roof was still green, the nail heads still bright. The floor of the shaft was less littered with crumbled rock and decades of dust. This was where Hermit Jim had been working, digging down, following the seam of bright yellow metal. As she walked, Lana grew afraid in a new way. She had endured the panicky, choking fear of death. This was different. This new sensation turned her muscles to jelly, seemed to sap the heat from her blood and fill her arteries with ice water and her stomach with bile. She was cold, cold all the way through. Her feet weighed 100 pounds each, the muscles inadequate to lift them and shift them forward. Every corner of her brain was yammering, "Run, run, run!" But she could not possibly run, could not physically do it. The only way was forward, as she felt herself now drawn deeper and deeper by some will that was no part of her. Patrick finally could take it no longer. He turned tail and ran, shouldering his way past the contemptuous wild dogs. She wanted to call him, but no sound came from her nerveless lips. Deeper and deeper, colder and colder. The flashlight weakened, and as it dimmed, Lana became aware that the walls of the cave were glowing a faint green. It was near now. It. Whatever it was near. The lantern fell from her numb fingers. Her eyes rolled up into her head, and she fell to her knees, indifferent to, unaware even, of the pain as her kneecaps landed on sharp rock. On her knees, eyes blind, Lana waited. A voice exploded inside of her head. Her back arched in spasm, and she fell on her side. Every nerve ending, every cell in her body screamed in pain. Pain like she was being boiled alive. How long it lasted, she would never know. The exact words she heard, if they had been words at all, she would never recall. She would awake later, having been dragged from the cave by two of the coyotes. They dragged her out of the cave into the night. And there they waited patiently for her to live or die. 28. 123 hours, 52 minutes. Sam, Adelio, Quinn, Astrid, and Little Pete followed the phase wall out to sea. The curve of the barrier took them away from land, then back toward it. There was no gap in the wall. There was no easy escape hatch. The sun was setting as they traveled north of a handful of tiny private islands. One of those islands had a beautiful white yacht smashed into it. Sam considered detouring to take a closer look, but decided against it. He was determined to survey the entire phase wall. If he was to be trapped like a goldfish in a bowl, he wanted to see the whole bowl. The phase wall met the shore in the middle of Stefano Rey National Park, having inscribed a long semicircle on the face of the eerily placid sea. The shoreline was impossible, a fortress of jagged rock and cliffs touched with the golden light of the setting sun.
"It's beautiful,"
Astrid said. "I'd rather have ugly in a place to land," Sam said. The surf was still tame, but it would take very little for the rocks to tear a hole in the hull of the already crippled Boston Whaler. They headed south, creeping along, hoping for a place to put in before the gas tank ran empty and night fell. Finally, they spotted a minuscule spit of sand, a V-shape, no more than 12 feet wide and half as deep. Sam figured he could, with luck, run the boat in there and beach it. But the boat would not survive for long, and they would be on foot, without a map, at the bottom of a 70-foot cliff. "How's the gas look, Adelio?" Adelio stuck a stick down into the tank and pulled it back up.
"Not much. Maybe an inch."
"Okay. Well, I guess this is it, then. Tighten up your life jackets." Sam pushed the throttle forward and aimed straight for the tiny beach. He had to keep up speed or the sluggish swell would shove him into the rocks that crowded in on both sides. The boat ran up on the sand. The impact jolted Astrid, but Adelio caught her hand before she fell. The four of them quickly piled out. Little Pete could not be induced to get out, or even to acknowledge their existence. So Sam, fearful that at any moment Little Pete might freak out and choke him, or teleport him, or at least start howling, carried the boy ashore. Adelio took with him the boat's emergency kit, which amounted to little more than a few band-aids, a book of matches, two emergency flares, and a tiny compass. "How do we get Little Pete up this cliff?" Sam wondered aloud. "It's not a really hard climb, but..."
"He can climb," Astrid said. "He climbs trees sometimes, when he wants to."
Sam and Adelio wore identical expressions of doubt.
"He can," Astrid said. "I just need to remember the trigger words. Something about a cat."
"Okay."
"He followed a cat up a tree once."
"I don't know if we have tides anymore," Quinn said. "But if we do, this beach is going to be underwater soon."
"Charlie Tuna," Astrid said.
The three boys stared at her.
"The cat," she explained. "His name was Charlie Tuna."
She crouched next to Little Pete.
"Petey. Charlie Tuna? Charlie Tuna, remember?"
"This is not too crazy,"
Quinn muttered under his breath. Sam said, "Okay, how about, Adelio, you go first, then Astrid, so Little Pete will follow you. Quinn and I will come last in case LP slips." It turned out Astrid was right. Little Pete could climb. In fact, he almost passed Astrid on the way up. Nevertheless, it took them till dark to gain the top of the cliff. By the time they finally collapsed on a bed of grass and pine needles beneath towering trees, they needed every one of the band-aids Adelio had brought.
"I guess we sleep here," Sam said. "It's warm out," Astrid said.
"It's dark," Sam said.
"Let's light a fire,"
Astrid said.
"Keep the bears away, huh?"
Adelio agreed nervously.
"That's a myth, unfortunately,"
Astrid said.
"Wild animals see fire all the time. They're not especially scared of it."
Adelio shook his head ruefully.
"Sometimes, Astrid, you knowing everything isn't really helpful."
"Understood,"
Astrid said.
"What I meant to say was that bears, like all wild animals, are terrified of fire."
"Yeah, too late."
Adelio peered nervously into the blacker-than-black shadows beneath the trees. Astrid and Adelio watched Little Pete while Sam and Quinn searched for firewood. Quinn, nervous for more than one reason, said,
"This isn't me dogging you or anything, Sam, but... brah, if you really do have some kind of magic, you need to be figuring out how to use it."
"I know," Sam said.
"Believe me, if I knew how to turn on a light, I would."
"Yeah, you always have been scared of the dark."
After a while, Sam said,
"I didn't think you knew that."
"It's no big thing. Everybody's scared of something,"
Quinn said softly.
"What are you scared of?"
"Me?"
Quinn paused, holding his few sticks of firewood, and considered.
"I guess I'm scared of being a nothing. A great big... nothing."
They collected enough wood and enough pine needles for kindling, and soon they had a cheerful, if smoky, fire burning. Adelio stared into the flames.
That's better, even if it doesn't scare any bears. Plus, I'm not on that boat anymore. I like solid land.
The warmth of the fire was unnecessary, but Sam enjoyed it anyway. The orange light reflected dully from tree trunks and branches and made the night even darker. But while the fire burned, they could pretend to be safe.
"Anyone know any ghost stories to tell?"
Adelio asked, half joking.
"You know what I'd like?" Astrid asked. "S'mores. I was at camp once. It was an old-fashioned camp with fishing and horseback riding and these awful sing-alongs by the fire. And s'mores. I didn't like them then, mostly because I didn't want to be at camp. But now..."
Sam peered at her through the flames. The starched white blouses of the pre-phase had given way to t-shirts. And he wasn't completely intimidated by her anymore, not now that he'd been through so much with her. But she was still so beautiful that sometimes he had to look away. And the fact that he had kissed her meant that now every thought of her came with a flood of overwhelming memories, scents, sensations, tastes. He fidgeted and bit his lip, using the pain to keep him from thinking any more about Astrid and her shirt and her hair and skin.
"Not the time, not the place,"
he muttered under his breath. Little Pete sat, legs crossed, and stared into the fire. Sam wondered what was going on in his head. He wondered what power was concealed behind those innocent eyes.
"Hungry,"
Little Pete said.
"Munchy, munchy."
Astrid gave him a hug.
"I know, little brother. We'll get food tomorrow."
One by one, they felt their eyelids grow heavy. One by one, they stretched out, fell silent, slept. Sam was the last. The fire was dying. The darkness was moving in from every direction. He sat cross-legged, crisscross applesauce, they called it when he was in kindergarten, turned his hands around, palms up, and lay them on his knees.
How? How did it happen? How had this happened to him? How could he control it, make it happen on command?
He closed his eyes and tried to recall the panic he'd felt whenever he had created light. It wasn't hard to remember the emotion, but it was impossible to feel it. As quietly as he could, he stole away from the fire. The darkness under the trees might conceal a thousand terrors. He walked toward his fear. Pine needles crunched beneath his feet. He walked until he could only just make out the faint glow of the fire's embers behind him and could no longer smell the piney smoke. He raised his hands, the way he'd seen Cain do, palms out, like he was signaling someone to stop, or else like he was a pastor blessing a congregation. He dredged up the fear of that nightmare in his bedroom, the panic when little Pete was choking him, the sudden reaction when the fire starter tried to kill him. Nothing. It wasn't going to work. He couldn't simulate fear, and trying to scare himself with a dark forest wasn't working either. He spun, a noise behind him.
"It's not working, is it?"
Astrid said.
"It almost did. You almost scared me enough to make it happen,"
Sam said.
Astrid came closer. "I have a terrible thing I want to tell you."
"A terrible thing?"
"I betrayed Petey. Drake. He wanted me to call him a name."
She was twisting her fingers together so hard, it looked painful.
Sam took her hands in his.
What did he do?
Nothing. Just...
Just what?
He slapped me a couple of times. It wasn't so bad, but...
He hit you? It felt like he had swallowed acid.
He hit you?
Astrid nodded. She tried to explain, but her voice betrayed her. So she pointed at the side of her face, at the place where Drake's hand had hit her with enough force to jerk her head sideways. She steadied and tried again.
No big deal. But I was scared. Sam, I was so scared.
She stepped closer, wanting maybe to have his arms around her. Sam took a step back.
I hope he's dead, he said. I hope he's dead, because if he isn't, I'll kill him.
Sam.
His fists were clenched. It felt like his brain was boiling inside his skull. His breath came shallow and harsh.
Sam,
Astrid whispered.
Try it now.
He stared, uncomprehending.
Now!
She yelled. Sam raised his hands, palms out, aimed toward a tree.
Ah!
He yelled, and bolts of brilliant green-tinged light shot from his hands. He dropped his hands to his side, panting, stunned by what he had done. The tree was burned through. It fell, slowly at first, then faster, and crashed heavily in a patch of thorn bush. Astrid came up behind him and slid her arms around him. He felt her tears on the back of his neck, her breath in his ear.
I'm sorry, Sam.
Sorry?
You can't summon fear whenever you need it, Sam. But anger is fear aimed outward. Anger is easy.
You manipulated me?
He untwined her arms and turned to face her.
It happened with Drake, just like I told you,
Astrid said.
But I wasn't going to tell you until I saw you out here trying. You kept saying it was fear that made the power work. So I thought...
Yeah.
He felt strangely defeated. He had just, for the first time, willed the light to come. But he felt sad, not elated.
So I have to be mad, not scared. I have to want to hurt people.
You'll learn to control it,
Astrid said.
You'll get better at it, so that you can use the power without having to feel anything.
Well, won't that be a happy day?
Sam said with bitter sarcasm. I'll be able to burn someone without feeling anything.
I'm sorry, Sam. I really am. Sorry for you, I mean. Sorry this has to happen. You're right to be afraid of the power. But the truth is, we need you to have this power.
They stood, distant from each other, though only a foot apart. Sam's mind was far away, playing out memories from a time that seemed like a million years ago. A million years, or maybe just 8 days.
Sorry.
Astrid whispered again, and threaded her arms beneath his to pull him against her. He rested his chin on her head, looking past her, seeing the fire, seeing the darkness everywhere else. The darkness that had scared him ever since he was a baby.
Sometimes you catch the wave. Sometimes the wave catches you,
he said at last.
It's the phase, Sam. It's not you. It's just the phase.
29. 113 hours, 33 minutes. Lana's foot caught a root, and she fell onto her hands and knees. Patrick bounded over to look at her, but kept his distance. Nip, the coyote, who was Lana's personal tormentor, snapped his jaws at her.
"I'm getting up. I'm getting up,"
Lana muttered. Her hands were scraped. Again. Her knees were bloody. Again. The pack was well out in front, weaving through sagebrush, leaping ditches, stopping to sniff at gopher holes, then moving on. Lana could not keep up. No matter how fast she ran, the coyotes always outpaced her. And when she fell behind, Nip would snap at her heels and occasionally draw blood. Nip was a low-ranked coyote, anxious to prove himself to pack leader. But he wasn't vicious, not like some of them, so he wouldn't rip and tear at her with his teeth. He would only snarl and snap. But when she delayed the pack with her slow, clumsy human running, then pack leader would snarl at Nip and slash at him, while Nip whimpered and abased himself. Patrick was lowest of all in status, lower even than Lana. He was a big, strong dog, but he bounded along with his tail wagging, his tongue lolling, which the swift, efficient coyotes seemed to find contemptible. The coyotes were solitary hunters, catching even the fastest rabbits or squirrels. Patrick was left to his own devices, and since he was much slower, he was going hungry. Lana had been offered one of pack leader's kills, a half-eaten, still half-alive jackrabbit, but she wasn't that hungry. Yet. She had almost forgotten that none of this was possible. Amazing how quickly she had come to accept a world defined by a giant barrier. Absurd that she knew she could heal with a touch. Ridiculous that she had accepted the fact that pack leader could speak. In words. In English, however garbled. Madness. Insanity. But what had happened down in that mine, down where the seething darkness hid, far from the sun, far from the world of reason, had killed whatever doubt remained for Lana. The world had gone crazy. She had gone crazy. Lana's task now was to survive, not to analyze or understand, just to survive. Her shoes were already beginning to fall apart. Her clothing was ripped in several places. She was filthy. She'd had to urinate and defecate in the open, like a dog. Her legs and hands had been repeatedly torn by sharp rocks, sliced by thorns, stabbed by mosquitoes. She had even been bitten by a cornered raccoon. But the wounds never lasted long. They hurt, each time they hurt, but Lana healed them. They had run throughout the night, the coyotes, chasing the next meal. It had been just 12 hours or so, but already it seemed like forever.
"I'm a human," she told herself. "I'm smarter than he is. I'm superior. I'm a human being."
But here in the wild, in the dark desert night, she wasn't superior. She was slower and more clumsy and weaker. To keep her spirits up, Lana talked to Patrick, or to her mother. That, too, was crazy.
"Really enjoying my time here, Mom,"
Lana said.
"I'm losing a little weight. The coyote diet. Don't eat anything and run all the time."
Lana fell into a hole and felt her ankle twist and break. The pain was excruciating. But the pain would last only a minute. The exhaustion was far deeper. The despair more painful. Pack leader appeared, looking down at her from a jutting rock.
"Run faster,"
Pack Leader ordered.
"Why are you keeping me prisoner?"
she demanded.
"Kill me or let me go."
"The darkness says no kill,"
Pack Leader said in his tortured, high-pitched, inhuman voice. She did not ask him what he meant by the darkness. She had heard its voice in her head down at the bottom of Hermit Jim's gold mine. It was a scar on her soul, a scar her healing power could not touch.
"I'm only slowing you down,"
Lana sobbed.
"Leave me here. Why do you want me around?"
"Darkness say you teach. Pack leader learn."
"Learn what?"
she cried.
"What are you talking about?"
Pack leader leapt at her, knocked her flat on her back, and stood over her with his teeth bare above her exposed throat.
"Learn to kill humans. Gather all packs. Pack leader, leader of all. Kill humans."
"Kill all humans? Why?"
Pack leader was salivating. A long string of slobber fell from his muzzle onto her cheek.
"Hate human. Human kill coyote."
"Stay out of towns and no one kill coyote,"
Lana argued.
"All for coyote. All for pack leader. No human."
With his strained, unworldly voice, pack leader couldn't really rant for long, but the fury and hatred came through in very few words. She didn't know what a sane coyote would sound like if it could talk, but there was no doubt in her mind that this was an insane coyote. Animals didn't get grandiose ideas about obliterating a whole species. That thought had not come from pack leader. Animals thought about food and survival and procreation, if they thought at all. The thing in the cave. The darkness. Pack leader was its victim, as well as its servant. The darkness had filled pack leader with this evil ambition. But it had not been able to teach pack leader the ways to take on the humans. When Lana appeared at the gold mine, the darkness had seized the opportunity to use her. There were limits to the power of the darkness, no matter how terrifying it might be. It needed to use the coyotes and Lana to carry out its will. And there were limits to what the darkness knew as well. She knew what she had to do.
"Go ahead. Kill me,"
Lana said. She arched her neck, presenting it for him, defiant.
"Go ahead."
One quick bite, and it would all be over. She would let the wound bleed. She wouldn't heal it, but would let her arteries pump her life out onto the desert sand. At that moment, part of Lana wasn't sure she was bluffing. The darkness had opened a door in her mind, a door to something almost as frightening as the darkness itself.
"Go ahead,"
she challenged the coyote.
"Go ahead and kill me."
The coyote leader faltered. He let loose an anxious, mewling sound. He had never caught helpless prey that did not struggle for life. It was working. Lana pushed pack leader's wet muzzle away. She stood up, her ankle still painful.
"If you're going to kill me, kill me."
Pack leader's brown and yellow eyes burned holes in her, but she did not back down.
"I'm not afraid of you."
Pack leader flinched. But then, his eyes went to Patrick and back, with a sly, sideways leer.
"Kill dog."
It was Lana's turn to flinch. but she knew instinctively that she could not show weakness.
Go ahead. Kill him. Then you'll have no way to threaten me.
Again, Pack Leader's scarred face showed confusion. The thought was complicated. It was a thought with more than one move, like trying to play chess and anticipate what would happen two or three moves further on. Lana's heart leapt. Yes, they were stronger and faster. But she was a human being, with a human brain. The coyotes had changed in some ways from what they had been. Some had muzzles and tongues that now allowed tortured speech, and they were bigger than they should have been, stronger than they should have been, even smarter than they had any right to be. But they were still coyotes, still simple, driven by hunger, by the desire for a mate, by a need for a place within the pack. And the darkness had not taught them how to lie or bluff.
"The darkness says you teach,"
Pack Leader said, falling back on familiar territory.
"Fine,"
Lana said, her brain buzzing, trying to decide where to lead this conversation, looking for the advantage.
"You leave my dog alone, and you get me some decent food. Some food that humans eat, not filthy, half-chewed rabbits. And then I'll teach."
"No human food here."
"That's right, you filthy, mangy animal," Lana thought, as the next move fell into place. "No human food here."
"I noticed,"
she said, tamping down the triumph in her voice, keeping her face carefully neutral, giving nothing away.
"So take me to the place where the grass grows. You know what I'm talking about. The place where the patch of green grows in the desert. Take me there, or take me back to the darkness, and tell the darkness you cannot control me."
Pack Leader didn't like that, and he expressed his frustration not in human speech, but in a series of angry yipping sounds that reduced the rest of the pack to anxious skulking. He twisted away from her in a pantomime of frustration, unable to control or hide his simple emotions.
"See, Mom?"
Lana whispered as she pressed healing hands on her ankle.
"Sometimes defiance is a good thing."
Finally, without a word, Pack Leader trotted off toward the northeast. He moved, and the pack followed, but slowly, at a pace that Lana could match. Patrick fell into step beside his master.
"They're smarter than you, boy,"
Lana whispered to her dog.
"But they're not smarter than me."
"Wake up, Jack."
Computer Jack had fallen asleep at the keyboard. He was spending nights in the town hall, working to deliver on his promise of assembling a primitive cell phone system. It wasn't easy, but it was fun. And it took his mind off other things. It was Diana who had awakened him, shaking his shoulder.
"Oh, hi,"
Computer Jack said.
"That computer keyboard face, it's not a great look for you."
Jack felt his face and blushed. There were imprints of the square keys on his cheek.
"Big day today,"
Diana said, moving across the room to the small refrigerator. She pulled out a soda, popped it open, raised the window shade, and drank while looking down at the plaza. Computer Jack adjusted his glasses. One side was a little askew.
"It's a big day? Why?"
Diana laughed in her knowing way.
"We're going home for a visit."
"Home?"
It took Jack a few seconds to click.
"You mean to Coates?"
"Come on, Jack. Say it like you're excited."
"Why are we going to Coates?"
Diana came to him and put her hand against his cheek.
"So smart, and yet so slow sometimes. don't you ever read that list Kane has you keep? You remember Andrew? It's his happy 15th. We have to get up there before the hour of doom.
Do I have to go? I have all this work to do.
Fearless Leader has a plan that includes you,
Diana said. She spread her hands, dramatic, like she was a magician revealing the payoff of an illusion.
We're going to film the big moment.
Jack was both frightened and excited by the idea. He loved anything involving technology, especially when it gave him an opportunity to show off his technical knowledge. But, like everyone, he'd heard what happened to the twins, Anna and Emma. He did not want to see anyone die, or disappear, or whatever it was they did. Yet, it would be fascinating.
The more cameras, the better,
Jack mused aloud, already working on the problem, already picturing the layout.
If it happens in a flash, we'll have to get lucky to get a shot at the precise second. A digital video, not stills. As expensive and high-end as Drake can find. Each one has to have a tripod, and we'll need lots of light. It would be best if we had a simple background, you know, like a white wall or something. No, wait, maybe not white. Maybe green, that way I can chroma key. Also...
He stopped himself, embarrassed that he'd gotten carried away and not liking what he was about to say.
Also what?
Look, I don't want Andrew to get hurt.
Also what, Jack?
Diana pressed.
Well, what if Andrew doesn't want to just stand there? What if he moves? Or tries to run away?
Diana's expression was hard to read.
You want him tied down, Jack?
Jack looked away. He hadn't meant to say that. Not exactly. Andrew was nice enough. For a bully.
I didn't say I want him tied down,
Jack said, emphasizing the word want.
But if he moves out of frame, out of where the cameras are pointed...
Diana said,
You know, Jack, sometimes you worry me.
Computer Jack felt a flush crawl up his neck.
It's not my fault,
he said hotly.
What am I supposed to do? And anyway, who do you think you are? You do whatever Kane says, same as me.
It was as angry as Jack had ever allowed himself to be in front of Diana. He flinched, waiting for her biting reply. But she answered softly.
I know what I am, Jack. I'm not a very nice person.
She pulled a rolling chair up and sat down close to him, close enough that her nearness made him uncomfortable. Jack had only recently begun to really notice girls, and Diana was beautiful.
Do you know why my father sent me to Coates?
Diana asked. Jack shook his head.
When I was 10 years old, Jack, younger than you, I found out my father had a mistress. Do you know what a mistress is, Jack?
He did. Or at least thought he did.
So I told my mother about the mistress. I was mad at my father because he wouldn't get me a horse. My mom freaked out. Big scene between my mom and dad. Lots of screaming. Mom was going to get a divorce.
Did they get a divorce?
No. There wasn't time. Next day, my mom slipped and fell down the big staircase we have. She didn't die, but she can't really do anything anymore.
She pantomimed, a person barely able to hold their head up.
She has a nurse full-time. Just has to lie there in her room.
I'm sorry,
he said.
Yeah.
She clapped her hands together, signaling the end of sharing time.
Come on, let's go. Pack up your little techie bag. Fearless leader doesn't like hanging around.
Jack obeyed. He began stuffing things, small tools, a thumb drive, a juice box, into his Hogwarts shoulder bag.
It doesn't mean you're bad, just because your mom got hurt in an accident,
Jack said. Diana winked.
I told the police my dad did it. I told them I saw him push her. They arrested him. It was all over the news. Messed up his business. The cops finally realized I was lying. Dad sent me to Coates Academy. The end.
I guess that's worse than what I did to get sent to Coates,
Jack conceded.
And that's only part of the story. What I'm saying is that you don't seem like a bad person, Jack. And I have a feeling that later on, when you realize what's going on, you're gonna feel bad about it. You know, guilty.
He stopped packing, stood with a set of earbuds dangling.
What do you mean? What do you mean about what's going on?
Come on, Jack. Your little PDA of doom? The list you keep for Kane? All the freaks? You know what that list is about. You know what's going to happen to the freaks.
I'm not doing anything. I'm just keeping the list for you and Kane.
But how will you feel then?
Diana asked.
What do you mean?
Don't be deliberately obtuse, Jack. How will you feel when Kane starts going down that list?
It's not my fault,
Jack said desperately.
You're a deep sleeper, Jack. Just now, while you were sleeping, I held your pudgy little hand. Probably as close as you'll ever get to holding hands with a girl. Assuming you even like girls.
Jack knew what she was going to say next. She saw his fear and smirked triumphantly.
So what is it, Jack? What's your power?
He shook his head, not trusting himself to talk.
You haven't added your own name to the list, Jack. I wonder why. You know Kane uses freaks who are loyal to him. You know as long as you are completely loyal, you'll be fine.
She leaned so close he was breathing her exhalation.
You're a two-bar, Jack. You used to be a nothing. Which means your powers are developing. Which means, surprise, that people can acquire the power late. Isn't that so?
He nodded.
And you didn't bother to tell us. I wonder what that means in terms of your loyalty.
I'm totally loyal,
Computer Jack blurted.
I am totally loyal. You don't have to worry about me.
What is it you can do?
Jack crossed the room on shaking legs. Without warning, life had turned suddenly dangerous. He opened the closet. He drew out a chair. The chair was steel, functional, no frills, but very solid. Except for the back of the chair, where the metal crossbar had been squeezed till it formed the perfect impression of fingers, as if it were made of clay, not steel. He heard Diana's sudden, sharp gasp.
I stubbed my toe,
Jack explained.
It hurt a lot. I grabbed the chair while I was hopping around and yelling.
Diana examined the metal, tracing the outline of his grip with her fingers.
Well, well. You're stronger than you look, aren't you?
Don't tell Kane,
Jack pleaded.
What do you think he would do to you?
Diana asked. Jack was terrified now. Terrified of this impossible girl who never seemed to make sense. Suddenly, he knew the answer. He had a way to push back.
I know you did a reading on Sam Temple. I saw you,
he accused.
You told Kane you didn't, but you did. He's a four-bar, isn't he? Sam, I mean. Kane would lose it if he knew there was another four-bar out there.
Diana didn't even hesitate.
Yes, Sam is a four-bar, and Kane would freak. But Jack, your word against mine? Who do you think Kane will believe?
Jack had nothing else. No threat. His will crumbled.
Don't let him hurt me,
he whispered. Diana stopped.
He will. He'll put you on the list. Unless I protect you. Are you asking me to protect you?
Jack saw a ray of hope in his personal darkness.
Yes. Yes.
Say it.
Please protect me.
Diana's eyes seemed to melt, from ice cold to almost warm. She smiled.
I'll protect you, Jack. But here's the thing. From now on, you belong to me. Whenever I ask you to do something, Jack, you're going to do it. No questions asked. And you will not tell anyone else about your power or about our deal.
He nodded again.
You belong to me, Jack. Not Kane. Not Drake. Me. My own little Hulk. And if I ever need you...
Whatever you want, I'll do it.
Diana planted a butterfly kiss on Jack's cheek, sealing the deal. And she breathed into his ear.
I know you will, Jack. Now, let's go.
30. 108 hours, 12 minutes. Quinn was singing a song. The lyrics were a sort of gloomy homage to surfing.
That's perky,
Astrid commented dryly. Quinn said,
It's Weezer. Me and Sam saw them down in Santa Barbara. Weezer, Jack Johnson, Insect Surfers, awesome concert.
Never heard of any of them,
Astrid said.
Surfer bands, Sam said. Well, not Weezer so much. They're more ska punk. But Jack Johnson, you'd probably like him.
They were walking out of Stefano Rey National Park, downhill, down the dry side of the ridge. The trees were smaller and more sparse, mixing with tall, sere grasses. That morning, they had stumbled on a campground. The bears had gotten to a lot of the food there, but enough had survived for the five of them to eat a hearty breakfast. They now had backpacks and food and sleeping bags belonging to strangers. Adelio and Sam each had a good knife, and Quinn was charged with carrying the flashlights and batteries they had found. The food had improved everyone's mood quite a bit. Little Pete had come very close to actually smiling. They walked with the barrier on their left. It was an eerie experience. Trees were often cut in half by the barrier, with branches extending into it and disappearing, or else poking out of it. The branches that came out of the barrier did not fall, but they were clearly dying. The leaves were limp, cut off, it seemed, from nutrition. From time to time, Sam would check out some gully or peer behind a boulder, always looking for a place the barrier did not reach. But that soon came to seem pointless. The barrier reached into every ditch, every culvert. It wrapped itself around every rock, sliced through every bush. It did not fail. It did not end. The workmanship of the barrier was, as Astrid had observed, impeccable.
What kind of music do you like? Sam asked.
Let me guess, Quinn interrupted.
Classical. And jazz.
He stretched the word jazz out to comic length.
Actually,
Snake!
Adelio yelled. He danced backward, tripped and fell, bounced back up looking sheepish.
Then, in a calmer tone, he said, "There's a snake there."
"Let me see,"
Astrid said eagerly. She approached cautiously, while Sam and Quinn stayed even more cautiously out of range.
"I don't like snakes,"
Adelio admitted. Sam grinned. "Yeah, I kinda got that from the way you moved away so gracefully." He brushed some clinging dirt and dry leaves off Adelio's back.
"You should look at this," Astrid called urgently.
"You look at it," Adelio said. "I saw it once already. One look at a snake is all I need."
"It's not a snake," Astrid said. "At least, it's not just a snake. It should be fairly safe. He's down a hole."
Sam approached reluctantly. He didn't really want to see the snake, but he also didn't want to look like a coward.
"Just don't startle it," Astrid said. "It may be capable of flight. At least short flights."
Sam froze. "Excuse me?"
"Just step lightly."
Sam crept closer, and there it was. At first, he just saw the triangular head peeking up from the bottom of a foot-deep hole padded with fallen leaves. "Is that a rattlesnake?"
"Not anymore,"
Astrid said.
"Come around behind me."
When Sam was in position, she said,
"Look, about 6 inches below his head." "What is that?"
Flaps of leathery skin, not covered with scales, but gray and ribbed with what looked like pink veins, hung flat against the snake's body.
"They look like vestigial wings," Astrid said.
"Snakes don't have wings," Sam said.
"They didn't used to,"
she said darkly. The two of them drew slowly back. They rejoined Adelio, Quinn, and Little Pete, who was gazing up at the sky like he was expecting someone from that direction.
"What was it?"
Quinn asked. "A rattlesnake with wings," Sam said.
"Ah, that's good, because I was thinking we didn't have quite enough to be worried about," Quinn said.
"I'm not surprised,"
Astrid said. When the others stared at her, she explained.
"I mean, it's obvious that there's some sort of accelerated mutation at work in the phase. In fact, given Petey and Sam and the others, the mutation must have preceded the phase. But I suspect the phase is accelerating the process. We saw the gull that had mutated. Then there was Albert's teleporting cat. Now this."
"Let's get moving," Sam said, mostly because there was no point standing around moping. Everyone walked more carefully now, eyes down, very aware of what they might step on. They stopped for lunch when Little Pete started losing it and staged a sit-down strike. Sam helped make the food, then took his can of peaches and his power bar and sat alone at a distance from the others. He needed to think. They were all waiting for him to come up with a plan. He could feel it. They were a little bit above the valley floor still, out in the open with no shade. The ground was rocky. The sun beat down. It didn't look like there was much in the way of shelter or shade ahead of them. Just the barrier, extending on and on, forever and ever. From this height, he should have been able to see over the top of it. But Astrid was right. No matter where you stood, the barrier seemed to be equally tall, equally impenetrable. It glowed a little in the sunlight, but mostly the barrier never changed day or night. It was always the same faintly shimmering gray. It was just reflective enough that sometimes you could almost believe you saw an opening, trees that extended beyond the barrier, or a feature of the land that seemed to pass through a hole in the barrier. But it was always an optical illusion, a trick of the light. He felt, rather than heard, Astrid come up behind him. "It's a sphere, isn't it?" he said. It goes all the way around us. All the way under us and all the way over us.
I think so,
she said. Why do we see the stars at night? Why can we see the sun?
I'm not sure we're seeing the sun,
Astrid said.
It may be an illusion. It may be some kind of reflection. I don't know.
She stepped deliberately on a small twig and snapped it in half.
I really don't know.
You hate saying I don't know, don't you? Astrid laughed.
You noticed.
Sam sighed and hung his head.
This is a waste of time, isn't it?
I mean, trying to find a gate. Trying to find a way out.
There may not be an out,
Astrid confirmed. Is the world still there? I mean, on the other side of the barrier? She sat beside him, close enough to be companionable, but not touching.
I've been thinking a lot about it. I liked your egg idea. But to tell you the truth, Sam, I don't think the barrier is just a wall. A wall doesn't explain what's happening to us. To you and Petey and the birds and Albert's cat and the snakes. And it doesn't explain why everyone over 14 disappeared all at once. And keeps disappearing.
What would explain all that? He held up a hand. Wait, I don't want to make you say it again. You don't know.
Remember when Quinn said someone hacked the universe?
You're getting your ideas from Quinn now? What happened to you being a genius? She ignored the jibe.
The universe has certain rules, like the operating system software for a computer. None of what we're seeing can be happening under the software of our universe. The way Kane can move things with his mind, the way you can make light come from your hands. These aren't just mutations. They are violations of the laws of nature. At least the laws of nature as we understand them.
Yeah. So?
So.
She shook her head ruefully, disbelieving her own words as she said them.
So I think it means we're not in the old universe anymore.
Sam stared at her. There's only one universe.
The theory of multiple universes has been around for a long time,
Astrid said.
But maybe something happened that began altering the rules of the old universe. Just a little, just in a small area. But the effect spread, and at some point it became impossible for the old universe to contain this new reality. A new universe was created. A very small universe.
She took a deep breath, a relieved sound, like she'd just set down a heavy load.
But you know what, Sam? I'm smart, but I'm not exactly Stephen Hawking.
Like if someone installed a virus in the software of the old universe.
Right. It started small. Some changes in individuals. Petey. You. Kane. Kids more than adults because kids are less fully formed. They're easier to alter. Then, on that morning, something happened that tipped the balance. Or maybe several somethings.
How do we get through that barrier, Astrid? She laid her hand over his.
Sam, I'm not sure there is a through. When I say we're in a different universe, I mean we may not have any point of contact with the old universe. Maybe we're like soap bubbles that can drift together and join. But maybe we're like soap bubbles a billion miles apart.
Then what's on the other side of the barrier?
Nothing,
she said.
There is no other side. The barrier may be the end of all that is here in this new universe.
You're depressing me, he said, trying and failing to make it light-hearted. She twined her fingers through his.
I could be wrong.
I guess I'll find out in... What is today? In less than a week. Astrid had no answer for that. They sat together and gazed out over the desert. In the distance, a lone coyote trotted along, nose down to catch a scent of prey. A pair of buzzards inscribed lazy circles against the sky. After a while, Sam turned toward Astrid and found her lips waiting. It felt easy and natural. As easy and natural as something could feel that made Sam's heart threaten to break out of his chest. They drew apart, saying nothing. They leaned against each other, both reveling in that simple physical contact. "You know what?" Sam said at last.
"What?"
"I can't spend the next 4 days in a permanent cringe," Sam said. Astrid nodded, a movement he felt rather than saw.
"You make me brave, you know?"
Sam said.
"I was just thinking that I don't want you to be brave anymore,"
Astrid said.
"I want you to be with me. I want you to be safe and not go looking for trouble. Just stay with me. Stay close to me."
"Too late," he said, with forced lightness. "If I blink out, where does that leave you and little Pete?"
"We can take care of ourselves,"
she lied. "You're very confusing, you know that?" Sam said.
"Well, you're not as smart as I am, so you're easy to confuse."
He grinned, then grew serious again. He stroked her hair with one hand.
"The thing is, Astrid, I can spend the time being afraid, trying to find a way to escape. Or I can spend the time standing up. Maybe then if I do disappear, maybe at least you and little Pete... We could all just..."
She began.
"Nah, we couldn't.
We couldn't just hide out in the woods eating dehydrated camping food. We can't just hide." Astrid's lip trembled, and she brushed at a tear just forming.
"We have to go back.
At least I do. I have to stand up." As if to illustrate the point, Sam stood up. He took Astrid's hand and drew her after him. Together, they walked back to the others. "Adelio? Quinn? I have made a lot of mistakes. And maybe I'm making one now, too. But I'm tired of avoiding a fight. And I'm tired of trying to run away. I'm very... very worried I'm going to get you all killed. So you guys all have to decide for yourselves whether you want to go with me. But I have to go back to Perdido Beach."
"We're going to fight Kane?"
Quinn asked in alarm.
"About time," Adelio said.
"Welcome to McDonald's," Albert said. "How may I help you?"
"Hey, Albert,"
Mary said. She looked up at the menu, which had a number of items covered over with taped-on black construction paper. Salads had disappeared quickly. Milkshakes were gone because the machine had broken down. Albert waited patiently and smiled at the little girl with Mary. Mary noticed and said,
"Oh, I'm sorry, I should introduce you. This is Isabella. Isabella, this is Albert."
"Welcome to McDonald's," Albert said.
"Isabella is new. A search team just found her and brought her in."
"My mom and dad are gone,"
Isabella said.
"I know. My parents are gone, too,"
Albert replied.
"I guess a Big Mac and a Biggie Fries for me,"
Mary said.
"And a kid's meal for Isabella."
"Chicken nuggets or hamburger?"
"Nuggets."
"And would you like that Big Mac with a bagel bun, an English muffin bun, or on a waffle?"
"Waffle?"
Albert shrugged.
"Sorry, Mary, but there's no fresh bread to be found anywhere. I'm using anything frozen I can get for buns. And of course, there's no lettuce, but you know